Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Layoffs, pay cuts, wage freezes, furloughs. Companies are taking tough measures as our brutal recession grinds on. But how do businesses decide how to cut and who to cut by how much? Some go straight to layoffs. Others have tried to share the pain and save jobs. Some pay cuts are across the board. Some are tilted. What's smart here? What's fair? And what's the mood in the ranks as employees ponder whether it's we're all in this together or it's every man for himself or woman? This hour On Point, where the axe is falling and why in the Great Recession. You can join the conversation. How has the pain been shared or not in your workplace? How do you calculate the wisdom, the fairness, the effectiveness of layoff versus pay cut versus freeze or furlough? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. His recent essay, The Quiet American, says Americans have so far been pretty stoic in the face of job losses, pay cuts, unpaid leave. Greg Ipp, welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
So what's going on out there? Lots of layoffs all over the place, but we see lots of other decisions as well. I've never heard more in my lifetime more talk of pay cuts and pay freezes and wage rollbacks and 401k gone. What's the shape of this stew of responses, the cutbacks, Greg?
Well, that's right, Tom. And I think it's very interesting that as bad as the job situation is, if you just look at the unemployment rate, which is now 9.5%, the highest since the early 1980s, you actually don't get a full picture of just how bad it is out there, because it's not just companies laying people off, but they're also, with the workers that they still have, cutting the hours that they're working and in many cases freezing their pay or actually cutting their pay outright. And you're absolutely right. The anecdotal evidence of these compulsory furloughs and wage freezes and so on, it's really rampant. A consulting firm has found that something like 20% of firms are doing one of those two things, either cutting hours or cutting pay or some combination of both. And so I think that if you actually look at what's happening to the people who still have their jobs, you realize that they're under a lot of pain as well. It's not just the people who've lost their jobs.
So I'm looking at these numbers. Continuing claims for unemployment up 159,000 to 6.88 million. That's the highest since 1967. That is a long time. The June unemployment figures, another 467,000 jobs lost. That's the highest in 25 years. Wage increases, though you can barely put that word to it, 0.7% in the past 3 months. That's the lowest since the data began in 1964. I mean, these are a long time since we've seen action like this. Your headline is, you know, the quiet Americans, sort of stoic Americans. What do you mean by that? Americans are just taking it so far? And what do you make of that?
Well, Tom, what I found while I was researching the article was that the people that have been forced to take these furloughs and these wage freezes, for the most part, see it as a lesser of a variety of evils that could have been inflicted upon them. I mean, the refrain I heard over and over again is, well, at least we have our jobs. And, for example, in newspapers, in the media industry, an industry that you and I both know quite well, it's been under severe pressure for many years now, first of all because of the shift of readers to the internet, and more recently because of the collapse in advertising as a result of the recession. And so, for example, I talked to people at the Cleveland Plain Dealer who a month ago were asked for $5 million in cost savings. And after they got over their initial shock, they said, well, you know, it's worse than losing our – it would be worse to lose our jobs. And so – when the union negotiated what amounted to a 12% wage cut, which was through a combination of furloughs and actual reductions in hourly pay, it passed by a comfortable margin.
So they're willing to take it rather than lose their jobs. That's taking the wage cut is no guarantee against job loss. I mean, the stories are all over the place out there. Here's Aco Brands. They make swingline staplers. Everybody's probably seen those. And I'm looking, this is a few weeks back now, but they imposed a 47% pay cut just for 6 weeks. I mean, people are looking at all kinds of combinations of layoff
wage freeze, wage cut. There's no one flavor here, Greg.
Well, you've put your finger on it, is that even when people are put on furlough or had their wages cut, it isn't a guarantee that one day they'll eventually lose their job. Because as we've seen in the most recent data, the job market is not turning around yet. Now, there are signs that the economy could be bottoming soon. We've seen things like home sales stabilize. We've seen the stock market rally. There's evidence that manufacturers are no longer slashing production because they're trying to get their inventories into the right range. And so we could actually see the economy pulling out of recession sometime in the next six months. But it's a big difference between pulling out of recession and a recovery that is strong enough to create enough jobs to soak up those unemployed. So I think the job market could be weak for a while. And what you have with all those millions of people on the joining the ranks of the unemployed is a lot of competition for the jobs that do come open. And that means continued downward pressure on wages and continued pressure on unions and other employee organizations to accept reductions in benefits and pay in return for keeping their jobs.
Greg, you remind us that in the 80s and 90s, there was enough inflation that employers could just keep a lid on wages and it was effectively a pay cut. Maybe that's part of the reason it feels different this time. There's active pay cuts out there, not just waiting for inflation to eat up the value of a wage, but actively, you know, cutting by 3, 4, 5, 7% more.
Well, I think that's true. Now, economists have often puzzled over what they call money illusion. Why is it that people are willing to take a pay cut when it comes through the form of higher inflation, but not when it comes through the form of a reduction in their actual paycheck? And I think it has a lot to do with pride and psychology and about whether or not you can come home and tell your family that you're still earning as much as you did the year before. Now, in the current context, it's actually one of the hidden benefits that inflation is currently negative, but that's entirely because of a big drop in fuel prices, which is now over. The one thing that worries me a lot is that even if prices of stuff is going down because the economy is weak, the one thing that does not go down is your debts. If you're still carrying a big mortgage and your house is no longer worth as much as what you paid for it, it doesn't matter how much deflation there is out there in wages and prices, you're still going to owe just as much as you did on your mortgage before. And I think that if people are sustaining big declines in their wages, we're going to see more pressure, more defaults, and more stress out there.
Now, people know this in the workplace, and some are deciding as a result that they don't want to see layoffs. They'd rather all take a pay cut, a haircut, than see some of their colleagues out on the street. This is not long ago, just a couple days ago, from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Police officers, they're voting. This is the union voting to take 8 days off without pay rather than have layoffs. Is this common, more common in this recession than in others, Greg?
I think it is, partly because inflation is so low and partly because the severity and the speed with which the economy has collapsed has really forced companies and unions and workers to act very quickly. But it's not a simple matter if you're an employer trying to decide whether or not to do this, because notwithstanding the fact that in many cases employees are stoic about it, there are times when you have workers who are frankly demoralized by the fact that they took a pay cut even though they're working just as hard and they're just as productive. And in fact, one of the things that people have found in the past is that employers generally turn to layoffs because at least once the workers who are redundant were gone, the remainder sort of could feel that they were doing okay.
You quote Truman Bewley, economics professor at Yale, a sort of the national expert on this front. He interviewed lots of employers and employees in the 1990s to look at the decision of layoff versus pay cut or wage freeze. We have him with us today, if I may turn to him, in New Haven, Connecticut. Truman Bewley, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
You looked across the board out there and decided that for the bottom line, for the prospects of the company, layoff beats wage freeze, even wage freeze accepted in sort of solidarity to avoid individual pain. Why?
Well, it depends on the circumstances of the company, but the main arguments against pay cuts were, first of all, a pay cut doesn't save nearly as much money as a layoff because of fixed costs of employment, and it's not usually the case that pay cuts save jobs. It's very unusual for a company to be in a position where by lowering pay, it can save a lot of jobs. It can if the company is faced with closing because of financial stress, or if it has a very competitive product market where prices are falling, and it can, by paying less, reduce its prices and expand its markets. But those are unusual circumstances.
And you write a lot about morale. You say that layoffs get the pain out the door. That is, it's devastating to people who are laid off, but they're not around in the workplace anymore. Well, that may be true, but it sounds pretty tough, too.
It's very brutal. And the fear of layoff can be paralyzing, though it also stimulates employees to at least try to look good to the boss so they won't be picked next round. And a way to try to minimize that, the problem of paralyzing fear of layoff, is to store up layoffs and then have very massive layoffs all at once and try to promise that there will be no more layoffs for 6 months or so, and that we're keeping the core of employees here that we need to have in order to get the company out of this mess.
Given the findings of your research, Professor, are you surprised by the number of companies, government employers, and others who are trying wage cuts as an alternative to layoffs, who are trying not to have those layoffs because they can see how deep the unemployment hole is out there now?
Well, this recession is a lot more serious than the recession I was going on when, I was interviewing in the early 90s. And companies do cut pay, they did even in the early 90s, if they're faced with severe financial stress, and especially if they can save jobs by cutting pay, those companies that can. And another factor that's very important is if companies have employees with very important skills that are hard to replace, then they don't like to lose those employees by laying them off and having them find jobs eventually elsewhere. So they'll do what they can to try to keep them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how the pain is shared or not when cutbacks, layoffs, furloughs, and pay cuts hit the workplace of this great recession of ours right now. We've been joined by Truman Bewley, professor of economics at Yale University, one of the country's leading researchers in economics of what happens when recession hits the workforce and the kind of decisions that employers and employees make. Greg Ipp is with us as well, U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. We've got more voices coming, but let's hear from our listeners. Interesting stories out there. Charlotte, North Carolina, Kirsten. Hi, Kirsten. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you know?
I'm a small business owner, and as such, our goal was to make sure that we didn't lose any people during this. So if things got rocky, we wanted to shore up, and my partner and I took the pay cut. So we cut our salaries in March by 25%, and as things have stabilized for us, as they have, we've actually turned around and taken that money and started giving our people small raises.
So was there a point at which you thought it was so scary you might have to straight up lay off, or you never considered it?
No, we never considered it. We can't lose our people. If we lose our people, you know, we're a pretty small company, but we're extremely viable. Things are going well. And if we lose our people right now, we're not going to be able to compete.
And your employees then took none of the pay cut. You and your, founding partner took it all.
That's right.
Were you gigantically compensated, Kirsten, that gave you the freedom to do that, or did it pinch you to?
No, it pinches. It pinches. But, you know, better to pinch us that are, at least we know we've planned, we have rainy day funds, you know, we're in a better position to take it, whereas my employees, they're younger, they have families, they can't take the pay cut.
What if it goes on? We hope it for a turnaround. We hope soon. But what if it's not there? How long can you maintain that position?
I think we can maintain this position at least through the end of the year. You know, it's something that it's tough, but you know, I'd rather make sure I'm clipping my coupons than to lose someone that I absolutely have to have to run the business.
So there's the boss.
If I lose one of my employees, I'm done.
There's the boss, the owner taking the hit in Kirsten's case in Charlotte. Let me get a call right here from Pepperell, Massachusetts, and Debbie. Hi, Debbie. What's your story?
Hi. Well, my husband works in the automotive industry, which is obviously not a good thing right now. Mm. He's been there for over 20 years. He started as a mechanic. He now works in management with regards to he's a service and parts, I believe it's director or some type of title like that.
Yep.
Anyways, he worked for a dealership last year for a couple of years, and they were paying him well. And then at the end of December, they decided that in order to, I guess, cut costs, they would take, he gets a base pay plus a bonus every month by how the numbers look and everything.
Right.
They'd take his bonus away and cut his base pay by more than, let's just say he would have been making between $20,000 to $25,000 a year. That's it.
So they took away 100% of his bonus, and they cut his base pay by enough to bring him down to $20,000 or $25,000.
Yep. So, and then our health insurance that we were paying monthly was over $1,000 for our part of it. And we're a single-income family. We have been for the past 10 years. And so his boss finally said on January 1st or in that range, you know what, if you don't want to do this, I understand, but you're no longer welcome here. Because my husband said, well, you know, are you going to replace me? You know, do I have to train somebody? He was going to start looking for another job. The economy is really bad. He didn't want to leave. And his boss said, no, you're just no longer welcome here, and clean out your stuff.
So was that a layoff, a firing? How'd they count it?
See, this is where it gets better, because it wasn't counted as any of those things. He went to unemployment. He explained the situation. So from January to April, we had absolutely no income, had to pay for health insurance. Had to pay our, you know, mortgages, every bit, all the bills.
Yep.
And he went through some arbitration type thing, told, no, we technically can't, we think more, it's almost you quit, but you didn't quite quit. You weren't really fired. You weren't laid off. It was kind of in limbo. So for the first 4 months of this year, we had nothing.
There's the real deal from the front line, and it sounds like a complicated story at the end, but a lot of people are up against exactly that. And there, the employer trying to kind of muddle through neither this nor that. We're with Professor Truman Bewley from Yale, Greg Gipp from The Economist, and joining us right now from Princeton, New Jersey, Catherine Newman, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, author of The Missing Middle Class and Chutes and Ladders, Navigating the Low-Wage Labor Market. Catherine Newman, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you.
There's our caller, Debbie, and you can hear what she and her family have been up against. This is not an uncommon story right now. I mean, all kinds of threats to the juggler out there, from layoff to serious pay cut.
Well, it's particularly devastating in industries like the automotive industry, which are just almost disappearing in the United States. And there's not much incentive to be good to that workforce because the employers don't really see that industry coming back. Whereas the firms that think, as your earlier caller with the small business, that they're going to stay in business and that they've got skilled employees that they value, have a different set of incentives in front of them in terms of how they treat their labor force. It is brutal for people who are in sharply declining industries. There's no doubt about it.
What are you seeing? Truman Bewley looked at a lot of companies in the 90s, and the conclusion was layoff. It gets the pain out the door and puts the company in a better position to rebound. He's an economist. You're a sociologist. Is that the way it's working this time? Is there a different sociology around cutting versus layoffs versus sharing the pain?
I think there is a different sociology in the firms that can afford it. So we're seeing a lot more of the kind of adaptation you talked about in the beginning of the program, of furloughs, of shared pay cuts, even something I think quite unprecedented, which is what I might call progressive wage cuts, where the top takes a bigger hit than the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody gets a wage increase at all, it's people at the very bottom, which on skill grounds is exactly the opposite of what I think most economists would expect. But what I find fascinating about this, amidst all the pain, is a kind of less atomistic society than the one we've been told we have. So for many years now, we've been told we are bowling alone and that we're all out for number one, but we're starting to see the emergence of a kind of workplace community or ethic in which people are looking out for one another in ways that are surprising, given that atomistic vision.
You're not necessarily quite as on your own as we thought, a little more, collective spirit in there. Truman Bewley, how about it? Your research was in the 90s, but do you see that, sense that going on now? Does it make sense to you?
Well, the progressive pay cuts was the way it was done when I was interviewing. Management would take the big pay cuts and then it would diminish as you went down. That was a typical pattern when they did have pay cuts. And I think firms try to encourage an atmosphere of community. Well, it depends on the industry,
mm-hmm.
but that's very typical, that they want to have get people a feeling that the firm is looking out for them and they're looking out for each other, and that's part of good morale. Of course, that gets torn apart in times like this, And they try, there's no good answers to what to do. And they have a choice of, you know, sharing the work or pay cuts or layoffs, and that, those are complicated decisions. But if whatever they do, and especially when you have layoffs, they work very hard to rebuild that sense of community. And and they'll sometimes pay generous severance benefits to the people they've laid off in order to encourage people to believe that the company has the interests of the employee at heart.
Greg Ipp, I wonder what you see out there. I mean, here's a public institution, but this is University of California, and the president there announcing on Friday this plan where lots of furloughs and people making under $40,000, University of California, will get 11 furlough days. That's equivalent to about 4% of their income. People making over $240,000 will get 26 furlough days, 10% of income. So they're taking the bigger hit. But how does that work, Greg? 26 furlough days in addition to what vacation they've already got, I guess? I mean, can people really – that's, you know, that's 5 weeks plus in addition to vacation of being awake. Can they lose people at that level for the amount of time? Does it really happen?
Well, it's interesting. I think one of the reasons you've seen this happen so much, the pay cuts and the furloughs in the public sector, is that unlike in, for example, an auto company where demand has collapsed and they just don't need the workers any longer because nobody's buying the cars, in the public sector, at universities and government offices, the demand is still there. In many cases, it's gone up. And so it's tougher for them to turn to straightforward layoffs to deal with their problems because in California, for example, many offices are completely closed on Fridays, and that just means the people who called on Friday have to get in queue on Monday, and the demand hasn't gone down. It just gets bunched into fewer days. Now, I think the interesting question here, Tom, is what happens going forward? As Professor Newman said, this does kind of tilt at our view as an atomistic, every man for himself type of society. And I think one reason that it's had that character so far is because most people still think this is temporary. We're in a recession. Recessions end. Eventually, demand picks up. The pressure for wage cuts, hours cuts, layoffs will go away. And there is some reason to believe that's in fact the case. I referred earlier to surveys by compensation consultants that found something like 20% of firms had cut hours or pay. Those same surveys find that firms are not planning to continue to cut pay or hours by quite the same intensity because they're getting more optimistic about the economy, and that's a very good sign. The question is, what if that optimism turns out to be misplaced?
Catherine Newman, how about it? Do you see this less atomistic, less on your own spirit lasting? I mean, we're talking, people are talking about 9.5%, maybe 10% well into next year. Does this hold up?
I think it depends a great deal on how hard this bites. You know, if people find that they can't pay their bills and further cuts will make it impossible for their families to manage, they may be forced into feeling less generous toward their fellow employees. But for the moment, I think it is an expression of community within the workplace that's valued not only by management and but by employees themselves. I think there's another sociological issue out there that we need to think about, and that is if we start to see news like the news we received today about Goldman Sachs, you know, high profits, and we start to see big bonuses paid out again to people who appear to be extremely privileged.
Which the headlines say are coming in the case of Goldman Sachs.
Exactly. Yes. You know, some of this public patience may wear off. You said in the introduction that we're sort of going quietly into this recession, but I actually think the outrage and furor that was generated by some provisions of the bailout and the bonuses that followed wasn't very quiet at all. In fact, politicians found they had to be, I think, quite responsive. Whether they were able to do very much is another question, but they certainly couldn't run from the level of public fury. And so I think if we start to see that ethic wither under the great good fortune of some people at the very top, we may see a slightly more populist outburst than what we're seeing right now.
Let's get a call from Detroit, Michigan. Jay, you're on the air.
Well, I see these people making this so-called recession much worse. They're turning it into a depression. And missing from this discussion, except for that one previous caller, employers, the people who own the company, are not cutting their salary. They're cutting the salary out of the base people or furloughing them or making them suffer for 4 months. I mean, this is insane. It's just like, you know, with the credit card reform that Obama pushed through. we get credit card reform, and they universally turn around and jack all of our rates up over, you know, by 5%. These companies have essentially lost their mind, and some of them need to just go out of business. I mean, the nerve of AIG to ask for a big bag of money so they can give out bonuses when they owe $180 billion to the U.S. government. I mean, who in hell do they think they are?
Jay, we hear it. We hear exactly what Catherine Newman's talking about in your view right there. And, of course, that you're hardly alone in that. Greg, what do you think? I mean, you hear what Catherine says. You know, Goldman Sachs bonuses, AIG bonuses, you could get the populist sort of anger really back here. And this thing is really biting. Your headline was the quiet American, but how long does that last given the severity of what people are up against?
Well, like Professor Newman said, she was absolutely right. We did see that populist outrage last fall and then earlier this year, especially with respect to AIG. Yeah, it's definitely a problem. It's especially a problem for the Obama administration in the sense that they know that this crisis is not over and they need to keep sort of these companies on an intravenous drip of government support to keep the financial system together. Now, that said, I think that whether it may not be obvious from the headlines, but people in the financial sector, even the investment banks and so on, they're really suffering. I mean, what's remarkable about Goldman Sachs is that they may be the only firm that's able to have headlines like you're talking about written about them. Mm-hmm. Everywhere else, there's a lot of pain going on. Now, that doesn't at all speak to the relative consequence of that pain. When an investment banker's salary is cut from $2 million to $1 million, it probably hurts them less than our earlier caller's reduction in pay to $20,000 a year, I'm quite sure. But, you know, Professor Newman's right. I mean, these do have the potential to create a lot of populist outrage.
Truman Bewley, you remind us that good morale is not the same thing as happiness. Now, presumably employers don't want unhappy employees, but what's the distinction you're drawing there between productive morale or good morale and happiness in the workplace?
Morale is a military term, and, you know, soldiers can be miserable, suffering terribly, and be able to fight effectively. And they're aided in that, of course, by their training and so on, but also by morale. So it's not the kind of morale is really both a mood that's conducive to good work and also kind of commitment to the objectives and internalization of the objectives of the firm. Now, that mood may be angry, or it may be the mood that's conducive to good work may be happiness or it may be anger, depending on the circumstances, the kind of work done. Now, if somebody's dealing with customers, they should be happy so they can be cheerful dealing with customers. But if they're making tough management decisions or making very tough decisions within the company, they may probably it's good for them to be in a bad mood and to be savage. So companies do manipulate these moods or try to encourage a kind of mood with among different groups of employees.
So now, so grim determination can work in your research findings as a kind of morale.
That's right, exactly, depending on the circumstances. Now, in the book, I talk about an analogy which is kind of grim, but something I saw in lots of companies that perhaps it's useful to think of the workforce as people on adrift, you know, shipwrecked sailors adrift on a raft, and they have to get somewhere to survive. They have to paddle, and there's not much food. So, and some of the sailors are weak and some are strong, and what do? You push the weak ones overboard and abandon them. Now, that's a horrible thing. It might ruin the lives of the people who survive. But if they thought it was all done fairly, they would have good enough morale in order to keep paddling and get to safety.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how the pain is shared or not when cutbacks, layoffs, furloughs, and pay cuts hit the workplace. We've got a crew that really knows here this hour. Catherine Newman is with us from Princeton, professor of sociology, author of The Missing Class and Chutes and Ladders. Truman Bewley is with us from Yale, author of Why Wages Don't Fall During a Recession. Greg Ipps with us from The Economist. Greg Ip, is it true? Can we say this time out that wage stickiness, which economists like Truman Bewley write about, is still happening? Or, I mean, in a lot of companies, we see wages falling.
I think it's really being tested, Tom. I mean, wage stickiness, as you refer to it, is this phenomenon that economists have noticed over the years that, unlike other commodities where when demand goes down, so does the price for that commodity, with labor, the wage doesn't tend to go down. At worst, it usually just grows more slowly. And there's lots of reasons for that, a lot having to do with psychology, the types of issues that Professor Bewley referred to. I think it's really being tested right now just because the severity of the recession has been so hard on sales for so many companies, and they are fighting for their survival here. And plus, their own ability to raise prices and recapture the costs of higher wages is severely limited. That's the sort of deflationary environment we're in. And that's what's troublesome, because it's not out of the question that you could get a reverse of our traditional wage-price spiral, which is instead of wages chasing prices higher, we get wages chasing prices lower, which, as I mentioned, because people have such large debts, makes things much worse.
I'm looking at a survey here from Watson Wyatt. It's a human resources consulting group. They talked with companies who've had hiring freezes or layoffs or cutbacks. 62% of those who made hiring freezes, 69% of those who have made salary freezes plan to get rid of them within the next 12 months. But, you know, that leaves a lot who aren't going to get rid of them or don't plan to. 48% of those who reduce their 401k matches plan to reinstate them, but that leaves more than half that don't plan to reinstate them. Truman Bewley, do you see a different kind of bounce back or a bounce back at all this time?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't try to predict the future, but I think that what's different about this recession, it's unusual, is the financial stress on companies, and they really have to make all kinds of radical measures to save money during those, as a result of such pressures.
To stay alive, to be there, to have the chance to come back. Let's get a call from Bettendorf, Iowa, and Bob. Hi, Bob, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm not talking about Bettendorf so much as the Davenport and the neighboring larger cities here. Mm-hmm. But the glaring discrepancy between what city workers make, and they make, say, between $70,000 and $100,000 a year for, sidewalk inspector, housing inspector, that kind of a job, jobs that didn't even exist 40 years ago, so they're not essential jobs, and also police officers and firemen, I mean, they're making a lot of money.
And you don't see them taking the kind of cutbacks you're witnessing in the private sector?
No, not around here.
That is interesting. Let us look at that, Bob. Greg, I'll come first to you. What about it? I mean, surely some have taken them. The famous furloughs in California are eating directly into government employees there. But more generally, is there a tension between what's going on in the private sector, what's going on with the public compensation?
Well, I think it is generally the case that these sorts of pressures are less apparent in the public sector than in the private sector, partly because the government can often raise taxes when they're under pressure, and partly because the public sector tends to be more unionized, and so they have the ability to resist that. But I do think, although I can't be certain whether these types of phenomena are more common in the public sector, I think they're definitely more common than they have been historically, because as we've seen so prominently in California, a lot of states are really struggling with a devastating decline in sales taxes and property taxes and other sorts of revenue, and there really is no other way for them to cope with this.
But it's interesting to watch what unfolds here as so many private retirement plans are under pressure, 401k, 403b, contributions being cut back, state pensions still there and looking pretty good by private sector standards. Let's go to Rick in Lexington, Massachusetts. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I lost my job about a year and a half ago as a vice president of research and development at a biotech company.
Okay.
I lost the job not because I was involuntarily laid off, but because I was asked to lay off my entire R&D program for business reasons, which I gravely disagreed with. And so I asked to actually be part of the layoffs, and after some rather humorous fighting, was successfully laid off. The reasons behind this, I think, are something that's being touched on a little bit, but I don't hear being discussed explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the biggest reason for many of these actions are that companies emphasize maximizing profits as quickly as possible, as opposed to, say, getting enough profits or maximizing profits over a reasonable period of time. And, of course, doing things like cutting overhead through slashing wages or laying off staff is a very common thing to do. And in the year and a half since I've been continuing to look for a job, I've been studying this in other businesses. It actually seems to be endemic in our economy, I think, that all businesses do this. And I think maybe it's time to question some fundamental business beliefs here, that maximize or optimize, there's an important difference, and maybe we should look at our workers as investments and not worry so much about making those profits be higher than they were last year. And
you,
I'll appreciate your feedback.
Yeah, we'll do it, Rick. You laid your own job, yourself, across the tracks to save your R&D staff, and you all ended up gone. It's a year and a half ago. Does it look like it's worked for the company?
No.
Catherine Newman, what do you hear in this story? And could it be that with what we're up against, we're in the midst of some kind of changing understanding of what optimizing means versus maybe maximizing?
Well, this is a debate of very long standing as to whether American corporations are short-term oriented and somehow other capitalist enterprises in other countries think more long-term. There's certainly some aspects of our shareholder policies that do press in the direction of short-term gains, and undoubtedly, under those circumstances, we get pressures like the ones your caller has referred to. I don't think there are very many firms out there that don't think about maximizing profits. Their shareholders are demanding that they do so. But I think these questions about long-term viability, and in particular, investment in research and development, are very, very serious, because if we just rest on our laurels, we will find ourselves outclassed by other societies that are investing heavily in research and development. We're seeing a surge of investment in other places, and maybe we won't see the pain from that right away, but eventually we will fall behind. And of course, nobody wants to get out the violin for the university sector, because we're quite privileged, but we are a home of innovation, and if we see devastating cuts to the University of California, we're not going to see the human capital creation that state needs for its labor force to remain skilled, and we're not going to see the kind of research and development that has fueled the productive sectors of that economy. It's going to suffer, and in the long run, sounds like a luxury right now because we're so panicked about the short run. But the long run does catch up with us, as it has caught up with your caller.
Is there a changing sense of what's fair here, or what even works for the economy? I mean, we've come through several decades where the median income has fallen, where a lot of resources, a lot of wealth has flowed to the top of the economy. Is a recession like this a chance to rebalance, Catherine, or does that get in the way of restarting the economy?
I think you should ask the economists on this program that question. My own sense is that we don't really know how overall our citizens have fared in this economy in terms of what's left in their equity portfolios. We don't really know how this recession has affected inequality yet, which has been growing by leaps and bounds since the mid-1970s. And I think it's a very important question, not just a scholarly one, whether or not inequality will be somewhat mitigated by this or exacerbated by this recession. I personally don't think we have the data yet, but I'm going to be watching for it.
Truman Bewley, do you see this as a chance to rebalance the median, rebalance the distribution of wealth in the country, or as the wrong time to be doing that? Does it get in the way of restarting?
Well, I'm all in favor of doing that. But your caller was referring to cutting back on research and development, and that's a very typical reaction of firms in financial trouble to cut back on advertising expenses or research or any kind of investment just to save money now. It's because they're trying to survive.
Greg, you watch it from The Economist magazine. Do you see a move toward analysts and those who decide how a company's doing in the yardstick they're holding up against it, or is it the same, what's the quarterly report, bottom line, as our caller objected to, or is there room for some new measure here or not?
Well, I think at a firm level, it's difficult for an individual company to basically change their whole model to something other than profit maximizing, because essentially trying to make the most money out of the resources you have on hand is how you survive and how you serve your customers and how over the decades we've become a richer, wealthier country. The question about whether, as a society, we allow more of the benefits of growth to go to people at the bottom versus the top is one that I think is going to be played out at the political level here in Washington or in major forces. And I do see a change going on there. I think part of it's just a consequence of this recession. A lot of the rich who got very wealthy over the last few years did so because they were riding this financial bubble on Wall Street of flipping houses and property and so on. That money is gone. Those people are becoming poorer just by the force of the markets. But the other change is more fundamental, which is I think after a decade where the average household saw no real gain after inflation and pay, there is political pressure to redress that imbalance. This month, for example, we're going to see a substantial increase in the federal minimum wage, which was legislated some years ago after the Democrats took over the Congress. That, at the margin, will help to narrow this.
This is from $6.55 to $7.25 later this month.
Right. Mm-hmm. President Obama has made it clear that he wants to strengthen organized labor through small means and through larger means and so forth. And I think that companies themselves, especially in the financial sector but elsewhere, are beginning to question some of the approaches that they've taken on things like outsourcing and how much money they pay their top executives. So I do think change is coming.
Though the burden all over the place right now, blue-collar jobs, production workers, 16.3% unemployment. Professional, technical, creative, 4.8% unemployment. That's rather different bite right there. Let's go to Cindy in West Hampton, New York. Hi, Cindy. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you see?
Just a quick comment that, you know, the comment was made earlier that investment bankers may go from like 2 million to 1 million and that they have a cushion. And they do. I certainly don't worry about buying groceries. And I realize these are the kinds of things people are worried about.
Are you an investment banker or your husband?
My husband.
Okay.
But what we have experienced is going from a certain income level to much less than that. Some investment bankers went from making something like you quoted to much, much less. And as a result, there's like an entire group of support people that, you know, do get cut back in that process.
Support people like what do you mean by support people, Cindy?
People like babysitters. And people will help you clean the house. And I know cry me a river, right? But what I'm talking about are people who are actually very close with us and who are part of our sort of family unit, which you can even think about as being like a business. And I would say collectively, when you look at people who help us maintain a house, a painting project we were going to do this year, you know, a caregiver, you know, those are like five or six people who are no longer employed by us, who really will have to worry about, you know, buying groceries. I think it's just very easy in this debate to sort of look at the financial sector and say, you know, those people really caused this, you know, and that's sort of a different debate. But my point is simply that it's you know, there's a lot of pain being felt all over the place, and it's been horrifying to have to really hurt a lot of people who really do live at the margins.
So painful trickle down there for nannies and gardeners and whoever else may be work there. Cindy, thank you for your call. Let me get one more here. Columbus, Georgia. Russell, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
We're all right. What do you know, Russell?
Well, I just wanted to kind of give you some of the things that we've had to do. I own a service company. We sell industrial supplies to automotive and to home, and you know both of those have been hit. And we also sell to the government, which that sector has held up pretty well. But we had to make some hard decisions several months back, and we got everybody together and decided that it was best to have quote time off without pay. I didn't want to refer to it as a salary cut because that seems permanent.
Right.
So we instituted where everybody, being in the industry we are, we want to be seamless to our customers. So, you know, half of my staff takes Mondays off and half of them take Fridays off. And that's, you know, although nobody likes to be, even myself, you know, I took the same amount of cuts as everybody else.
Right.
In salary, along with no rent, you know, anything we could do to cut costs and get down to a manageable level, not profitable by any sense, but manageable, so we're not, you know, we had to stop the bleeding.
There's time off.
The morale has been quite good.
Time off without pay, everybody taking the bite, not the layoff path in your instance, and Morale holding up well. I'm glad to hear it on the morale front. I hope things turn around for you, Russell. Catherine, what do you take away from this American debate right now about prospects for American workers, and who sort of takes the pain? Who will?
Well, I think we are seeing that the pain is being borne, as it generally is, at the very bottom. The workers that your previous caller has had to let go, the household help, the service sector workers are feeling this. The lower educated workers feel it. The unemployment rates you quoted make that very clear. And this is one of the things that worries those of us in the higher education world as we see students melting away, as the University of California has to cut its intake, as tuition increases make it more difficult, because that human capital is part of what protects workers even in a time like this. Not 100%, of course, but the relative unemployment rates are dramatically different. And if we make it more difficult for people to become higher skilled, they're just going to be increasingly vulnerable in this world. So I think, unfortunately, it's sort of business as usual in terms of the pain being felt more keenly at the bottom than at the top. But what is dramatic about this recession is how far up the ladder the pain is reaching. It's really true that it is very, very widespread. And I would love to think it's going to come to an end soon, but I don't think we have any real confidence that that's the case.
Well, we will be watching as the arc of this recession continues to work its way through the American workforce. Catherine Newman at Princeton, it's been great to have you this hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Truman Bewley at Yale, thank you for joining us this hour, Professor.
Thank you.
And Greg Ipp at The Economist. Greg, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.